From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today in Grand Traverse County, a collision between the region's gun culture and a growing awareness of how firearms inform public debate.
No one apologized. The commission would have called, if they passed this resolution, called the incident well-intentioned, that's another quote, and kind of blamed Zoom meetings and how awkward they are, and then it kind of decried bullying in a general sense.
Also, how Michigan's winter rec culture is weathering a warmer climate.
The overall trend, especially in the southern part of Michigan, is fewer and fewer days of ice cover, measurable over the decades, not just year to year.
And singer-songwriter Chris DuPont previews new music and talks about why 2020 was the year he took a chance and turned to music full-time.
So I decided to just take a leap of faith at possibly the stupidest possible time, but it seems to have worked okay.
Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later in the hour, we're going to skate out on the lake and find out just how thick the ice cover is this year.
In some cases, we're seeing the longest ice cover on lakes that's ever been measured. Some years, there's less ice than ever. It's really volatile from year to year.
But first, Zoom meetings and virtual town halls going haywire is nothing new in Michigan's era of COVID-19. But Grand Traverse County has seen just how far things can go when people are conducting public meetings from home. Recently, County Commissioner Ron Klaus from Grand Traverse flashed a rifle when a member of the public questioned the commission on whether they would rebuke the Proud Boys and other extremist movements. Needless to say, the flashing of the rifle led to more public outcry.
This commission has had numerous problems since the leadership came on board, and this is just another in the line of succession. You guys need to, if you're not going to resign or step down, you need to at least be a man, be a decent taxpaying citizen, and apologize to this lady. If this lady's really getting death threats, step up, you guys. I mean, come on. I've almost had enough with you people with this. Just do the right thing.
Here to break it down for us is Max Johnston of Interlochen Public Radio. Hey, Max.
Hey, April.
Can we just take it back to the original meeting? What was the discussion that was happening before the commissioner flashed his gun?
Yeah, so they were sort of talking about a previous meeting, a pre-COVID meeting, in which the county board debated a symbolic Second Amendment resolution, basically putting the gesture out there that this county commission supports the Second Amendment. At that meeting, a few members of the Proud Boys, who some say were invited by some commissioners, I don't know if that's the case, spoke, and they spoke for a while. And people have been mad about the Proud Boys at that meeting for a long time, and board members have kind of avoided the topic, and a few times kind of defended the Proud Boys, saying, like, look, they followed all our rules and guidelines. And then sort of all that happened. And then in the wake of the insurrection at the Capitol, the U.S. Capitol last month, this resident, Kelly McIntosh, was asking them, in light of that, to sort of say or do something more concrete.
I'm not a gun owner, but I can certainly appreciate people's wanting to have their gun rights protected. But I would think everybody in our country would have to realize that permission has been given to these activist groups to do more with their guns than go out hunting.
And during that comment was when Ron Klaus went and got his rifle and brought it in front of his camera.
And what was the reaction he got?
I mean, in the meeting, no one seemed to really understand what was going on, and it was very brief, but almost immediately, people were extremely upset. I mean, the word went around town fast. I think within 24 hours, the local chamber issued a letter condemning Ron Klaus for what he did. A letter written by a local attorney got over 1,400 signatures. The BBC wrote a story. The Washington Post wrote a story. The board went ahead and canceled their next meeting to sort of get together and strategize. And I think one thing to keep in mind here is that during all this sort of immediate sort of response, Ron Klaus, the commissioner who pulled the gun out, and then Rob Henschel, the board chair, who laughed while Ron did this, didn't really say or do much in the terms of recognition or apologizing. Ron hasn't spoken publicly, and Rob, who I talked to the day after, said people were kind of just blowing it out of proportion. And I think because of that silence, because of that lack of sort of acknowledgement, that's where this tension is built, and that's why this story is sort of still going on.
Yeah. I understand that last week there was another meeting about the gun incident, and it really drew a lot of public comment. Can you tell us what was happening?
Yeah, it was a special meeting called kind of the last minute, sort of the day prior. And that's where the commission considered what I'm quoting here is a resolution of redress, whatever that means. In it, no one apologized. The commission would have called, if they passed this resolution, called the incident well-intentioned. That's another quote. And kind of blamed Zoom meetings and how awkward they are. And then it kind of decried bullying in a general sense. But it didn't acknowledge the situation or apologize for really anything. And that just got people more mad. So at this meeting you're referring to, there were like 4 hours of public comment. People called in calling it toothless and weak. I think people that may have been pleased with just an apology from Ron Klaus were suddenly asking for him to resign. That meeting was really, really weird. I listened to it in my phone plugged into my car. I was driving back to Traverse City from Lansing, and I missed like four exits because I was listening to people call each other like fascists and communists, and people were playing music over loudspeaker to drown other voices out. It was a mess.
Wow. Wow. How have the commissioners been reacting to the situation since the public outcry has I guess, gained a few more decibels?
Right. Well, Ron Klaus still has not commented publicly. He did not speak about this at the special meeting that I was referring to. Rob Henschel did offer, I think, something of an apology during that special meeting. Here's what he had to say about that.
It was not my intention that anyone would feel disenfranchised from their ability to come speak, and I do apologize for that effect that that had on some people.
And to be clear, that's Rob Henschel, not Ron, who pulled the gun out. Rob is the guy who laughed sort of along with it. And then other commissioners have said, look, this is counterproductive. This is not good for anybody. A couple commissioners, including a Democrat on the board, said this needs to have a more serious form of punishment, which is going to be on the agenda at the next meeting. So, you know, I mean, everyone's kind of reacting strongly, but the simple fact is Ron Klaus, the guy everyone's kind of waiting to hear from, hasn't said anything.
Did you get much of a sense of how the opposition to Ron Klaus's statement, you know, how it broke down? I mean, are there Republicans who are speaking out about this, or is it mostly concentrated among Democrats in the area?
No, it's pretty split. I mean, at the special meeting on the other week, someone did the tally of the 100 or so callers that called in. There's probably more than that. I think 80% of them were people that were critical of Ron Klaus and Rob Henschel. And that's including Republicans that called in to the meeting. That's including lawful gun owners who called into the meeting. I mean, it's ultimately a question of like just being a productive like elected official. And I think that was reflected in a lot of the comments. But to be clear, I mean, you know, up to 20% of the callers that did call in were there to defend Ron and Rob, say this was blown out of proportion, say, you know, this is people gunning for the Second Amendment, no pun intended. And so there was, you know, a fair amount of that discourse that was people defending Rob and Ron in this. But let me be clear, most people were condemning him, and it was really across party lines, I'd say.
Has the commission published its agenda for that next meeting yet? I mean, do we know what kind of censure Ron Klaus might be on the agenda for him?
There is a resolution of censure that was introduced by another commissioner that is on that agenda. And interestingly enough, this resolution of redress that I was referring to earlier, we're getting lost in resolutions now, was sort of tabled. They did not vote on that. It was tabled for a larger conversation with this resolution of censure Wednesday. So there's likely to be some more concrete resolution. A censure is like a formal punishment for, you know, an elected official. But, you know, there are calls for him to resign, calls for him to apologize publicly. We don't, I don't think, have a grasp on the specifics of what's going to happen there quite yet.
Max, gun culture has been historically a pretty big part of life in Grand Traverse County, but it feels like this year people are just a lot more dialed in to the way that guns are brandished, especially during the people's business, whether it's at the state house or in a public meeting, albeit on Zoom like this. What do you think this incident tells you about how politics are shifting in the county?
I mean, look, this incident, like this specific one, is a trend, you're right, on both sort of the presence of firearms in politics, which I think is a pretty regular part of politics up north, but more specifically the nationalization of, I think, local politics as a whole. I mean, this body, this county commission, has waded into hot button divisive issues that a county commission should not be wading into. And I think that's reflected of the staunchly conservative area that still is most of northern Michigan and how it clashes with kind of a newly progressive community that you see in places like Traverse City that are growing. So I think it kind of hammers home that innate clash, and also, frankly, how this like nationalization of politics, it can be just so counterproductive for local politics. I mean, just like this special meeting that I referred to that, you know, basically made me forget how to drive home the other day. The county passed a piece of legislation related to PFAS. They passed some money to get families hooked up to clean drinking water. That's good legislation. We're not talking about that, and no one is going to be talking about that because Ron Klaus decided to pull out his gun. So this nationalization stuff, what it does is just distracts people from the business that they should be doing, and that's why we're here.
Max Johnston of Interlochen Public Radio. Max, thank you for the update.
Thank you.
Are there days when you miss the show or you want to catch up after taking a break from the news? I just wanted to remind you, we've recently revamped the Stateside podcast. If you've got 15 or 20 minutes, we're giving you a compelling listen to an essential story from Michigan every weekday. And it's not just hard news, but interesting people, research, and stories from all around the state that you might otherwise miss. Like for today's podcast, I had an amazing conversation with a National Guard specialist from up north, Blair McIntyre, about President Biden's reversal of the ban on transgender servicemen and women in the U.S. military.
So this entire fight, I've been forced to go into work presenting as a male, even though I'm legally a woman, I'm medically a woman. I still have to go into work presenting male.
Sometimes in the podcast, we're fleshing out angles that we had to cut short on the radio or giving you just a little bit more context. I'm thinking about a recent episode right after the riot at the U.S. Capitol. We spoke with Congressman Dan Kildee about the growing rift in Congress and the two different understandings about what happened last Election Day.
From this day forward, I can't look at some of my colleagues the same way that I have in the past, where our differences are what makes us great. This is a different situation.
And sometimes we're just shining a light on stuff that we loved, like November's beautiful conversation with Michael Trotter and Tanya Blunt Trotter. Their band, The War and Treaty, made a triumphant album about strength in the face of tragedy.
As we continue to try to process what we were going through as a couple living in this country, one of the things that we decided to do was just be completely honest with how we felt.
Find the Stateside podcast wherever you listen. And don't forget to rate us and leave us a review. We're looking forward to hearing what you think. Coming up, singer-songwriter Chris DuPont on making a pandemic record at home that doesn't sound like a pandemic record made at home. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. 2020 may not have felt to you like a good year to take a leap of faith, but for singer-songwriter Chris DuPont, a perfect storm of changes converged, leading him to leave behind a day job and pursue music full-time. 2020 was also the year when he hatched a sumptuous new record that packs atmospheric soundscapes with all the pent-up feelings of emotional transitions and spiritual crisis.
True that I never learned to love right, for my will is half as good as my intent. I pray they both forgive me when he is a grown man. Start again, I could start again.
The album is called Floodplains. Chris DuPont joins us to talk about the songs and his songwriting process. Chris, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we heard that last summer you left your day job to focus on the singer-songwriter life, producing and teaching. Standard musician hustle. Finally.
Yeah. Yes.
I guess everyone had to have goals for 2020.
Yeah, I guess I chose a non-standard year to pick up the standard hustle, didn't I?
Yeah. Why did you decide to do this in the middle of a pandemic when people couldn't even tour?
You know, I may have lost my mind. So as if anyone's familiar with me in the Ann Arbor area, I've always kind of worn a couple different hats. I was a music minister for a long time at a church. And it worked out okay for me, kind of having that thing that I do, you know, watching my language once a week on Sundays and then, you know, being my musician self on Fridays and Saturdays and on the road. But it just got to a point where I couldn't continue doing both, and I really just needed to kind of step away and focus on being an artist. And also, strangely, the pandemic moved some chess pieces around in a way that really worked for me. It meant that steady work, such as music director jobs in many places, were sort of getting cut out of necessity, cut or made smaller. And at that time, I just decided, well, I know how to work on audio engineering remotely. I've always been doing it, and I figured out how to teach lessons remotely, and it ended up just sort of working. So I decided to just take a leap of faith at possibly the stupidest possible time, but it seems to have worked okay.
Were the songs that we're hearing on Sandpaper Hymn created during 2020?
So to an extent, I mean, I've actually been writing, this Floodplains record for a while. A lot of these songs kind of slow cooked, honestly, starting back in 2016. I'm not what you would call prolific. I'm so jealous of prolific writers, but a lot of these songs were percolating back in 2016, 17. And the creation of the songs, though, the recording and creation of them took place during parts of 2019 and much of 2020.
Yeah. It sounds as if you had some crisis going on within the larger crisis we were all experiencing.
I did. Would you like to hear about it?
I would. I never assume that just because someone puts it on an album, they want to rehash it yet again, but I was curious.
Yeah, I mean, so from hearing the record, you can tell that I don't have a lot of secrets. I decided to make this record at a really sort of bananas time. I was very sadly going through a change in family shape. I was going through a divorce. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be careful not to just make a divorce record, because I think many of us have heard those, and they kind of only suit like a certain season for people. Mm-hmm. And for listeners, I don't feel like they age well.
They sound really raw, but again, you know, it's like, how long are you going to live with that kind of, that level of sort of pain or anger or whatever it is you're feeling?
Right, exactly. And also, they're so fatiguing to tour on, because what if you get happy again? you know? So I was going through that, and thankfully, I mean, it's all, you know, my former partner and I are friends. She actually helped with the graphic design of this record. At the time, that was a crisis. And the church job that I was working at was sadly going through sort of a collective trauma and through a big upheaval that led to some people being removed and shuffled around. And I was sort of caught in the middle of that at the time.
Wow. So literally everything was blowing up in your life.
Yes, everything. My job, and obviously when you are on the Lord's payroll and something like that happens, that also, you know, wrecks a lot of your spiritual beliefs and foundations, sort of get rocked and turned inside out. And so really everything was blowing up, and it was such a stupid time to start working on a project, but in the end I'm really glad I did, because I love how raw it turned out.
What is this feeling hovering over that follows me to bed? Coldest of fingers pressing my lips, a fist upon my head. Call me liability from the start. That I could bring you more than the sum of our troubled parts.
If you're just joining us, my guest is singer-songwriter Chris DuPont. He's just releasing a new album called Floodplains. One of the things that's so interesting to me about the leadoff track, Retrieve. I mean, it sounds like you're definitely talking about these, you know, these chasms that are opening under your feet. But the theme that I got out of the song is patience. Patience with yourself and patience with others. It's probably a great mantra for our time right now as well.
Wow, thank you so much for that word. That's really gracious. I'm actually glad that that's what came through. I wanted to, that song was written as an anthem for someone close to me who was just going through unspeakable pain. And I do believe that people have to be loved and accepted where they are and just walked with and loved on their terms. And it's a thing I'm trying to learn how to extend to myself as well. But that's definitely what Retrieve is about.
Are the shadows cling to the best of us? Or who can partake in the breaking of your trust? Well, I'll pour you a glass of water when your teeth are red from licking your wounds. There is no shame in grieving what's taken far too soon. So whatever you want to tell me, oh, I believe it.
Chris, I have to ask, we've heard so many releases this year in which artists have, out of necessity, become bedroom producers, and mm-hmm. Floodplains does not sound like that at all. How did you make this record?
So I've been a bedroom producer for a long time. And I've sort of spent the past decade or so learning how to make things sound expensive when they're not, you know? And thankfully, what's wonderful about, recording technology right now and what's so great about being an artist despite this pandemic is that everything's sort of been set up for us to be able to do this. The only mm-hmm. change I would say is the necessity. So we did spend some time in commercial studios in Ann Arbor, like Big Sky and Solid Sound. Some of the drums were literally recorded in a garage. I worked with a producer named Nick Gunty from this wonderful folk duo called Francis Luke Accord.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a fantastic band. They put out wonderful music. He and I would basically just work on the record together from afar. We would just send each other files via Dropbox. And that collaboration is one thing that made it sound less bedroomy, was that and just a whole lot of patience, a whole lot of patience with the pandemic process. You know, I was recording vocals through a really nice microphone, but in a basement apartment where, like, if someone would take a shower, the vocal tick would get ruined. So a lot of patience, yeah.
There are going to be so many, there must be so many piles of tracks in so many people's trash folders of things that didn't work out that way.
Yes, absolutely.
Chris, you come out of a Christian songwriting tradition, and that's a house with plenty of rooms. But I do feel like lyrically, a lot of Christian songwriters use a little bit more straightforward form of expression rather than getting into some of the allegories and metaphors and exhaustive abstract things that happen in mainstream pop and folk songwriting. Does that come naturally to you?
So what's funny is my faith background has always had a mark on the way that I speak and process the world and the music that I write, but I've never felt comfortable writing music that could be used in church per se. I would, In many of my jobs and gigs leading worship music, I'd basically, you know, rearrange hymns and modern worship music to kind of suit the liturgy or the task at hand. Because I've always felt that the things that I have to say can't really fit in that paradigm. Like they wouldn't really fit the agenda of something like a retreat or a conference or a liturgy. They're more my story and my way of perceiving the world. And I felt like with this record, I pushed in two different directions. I went far more autobiographical, far more raw, while also co-opting more biblical imagery than I normally would to sort of suit my agenda. And so I think that no matter what I go through and no matter what deconstructing I do, I can't really get away from Judeo-Christian imagery as sort of punctuation to sort of drive my point home. But I don't feel that I'll ever be able to sit down and actually write music that would fit on a Sunday morning, because it's just not what I want to give people. I want to take the listener along with me through darker things, frankly, through pain and through sort of those moments where your head hits the pillow on a sleepless night, you know. And that's sort of what I tend to find myself gravitating to more heavily, especially lately.
Would you say that there are places that faith has come to occupy in the time you were writing this record that it didn't before?
Oh, wow. That's a great question.
Well, I mean, you said that there were aspects of your faith community that were sort of going sideways in the middle of this, but I don't know if any of that made it into the songwriting or if it's just more sort of where your head's been.
Yes, with my faith community going sideways, and also, frankly, just from a passenger's seat view, it's very strange being someone who, you know, plays church music for a living and has seen certain scary political movements get sort of equated with American Christianity, if I can say that on the radio. that's very spooky to me, and so I've often felt like a sort of a stranger, sort of a sojourner, just sort of watching things go sideways. And I want to say with this record, I just got a lot more comfortable with unknowns and with doubt and with pain being okay. Because, you know, my record Outlier, I really sort of wanted to paint this picture of a resurrected world, you know, of winter eventually turning into spring, and this sort of maybe naive and young view that everything will be made well in some way. And I wanted each song to do that. And with Floodplains, I just opted out. I decided, no, things just hurt. And I want to sit in that and allow it and not try to tie that up in a tidy bow. I just sort of want to sit with the fallen, painful reality and not necessarily try to take my listener to a happy ending. Until I wrote Lap of the Mountain, which is sort of a benediction piece that's, you know, very peaceful. But I definitely tried to sit more with pain and doubt and agnosticism, because that's just as much of a part of faith as anything else. I think faith that's certain is kind of fake.
Call me by the name that you've been speaking on to me from the time we lived together. Your fingers on my head, oil of anointing, because I was sick but now I'm better. When you lay me down beside you in the lap of the mountain at George's chest, my troubles are known. Let what I found there.
You know, that place of doubt and of having difficulty with faith, that's a place where a lot of us are finding ourselves after the events of the past 12 months. Since you're not doing much touring right now, can you tell us a little bit about where people can catch you online?
Yes, absolutely. I'm pretty active on Facebook and Instagram, and I will be doing a virtual release show filmed at Solid Sound Recording on February 5th. So through my socials, you can see video updates and live stream shows. And if it is safe and ethical to do so, and, you know, vaccinations pending, I may do some socially distanced outdoor shows in the summer. We, Ann Arbor did Tiny Tops this past summer, and that ended up really cool. So, I'm all over Facebook and Instagram, and I'll be sure to keep people briefed on those platforms.
Well, once again, the record is called Floodplains. Chris DuPont, thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you so much, April. I'm such a big fan of you and Stateside, and it's a real honor to be here.
Arts and culture coverage on Stateside is supported in part by an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Up next, ice fishing in a warmer winter. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The pond skating may finally be coming together in your corner of Michigan, but climatologists say that the winter freeze on the Great Lakes is not as cold as it has been in decades past. Still, Michigan's long tradition of winter sports is very much alive, despite conditions that can be challenging. Lester Graham of the Environment Report went out this weekend to find out what's happening with ice fishers, and he joins me now. Hi, Lester.
Hi, April.
So you've been seeing shanties out on the ice so far?
Yeah, I have. Actually, this weekend I saw ice fishers mostly with those shoulders that are like tents on sleds, but I also saw a couple of those built shanties dragged out on the ice. Mm-hmm. Just west of Chelsea, I saw them out on Crooked Lake and Kavanaugh Lake, and over the past couple of weekends, I've been seeing ice fishing on Wamplers Lake, Watkins Lake, Iron Mill Pond. That's a region where Washtenaw, Jackson, and Lenawee counties meet, more or less the Irish Hills area.
You know, it's all very well to go out there if it's just like a drainage pond or a little pond in the area, but I was curious, what's the ice like on the lakes? Is it actually thick enough that people are getting out there and doing what they usually do?
Yeah, those ice fishers, they're smart enough to measure before they start treading out there too far.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they'll auger down and see how thick the ice is. I saw some snowmobiles out there. Nobody was driving cars or trucks on the ice, but at Watkins Lake about 10 days ago, I saw a couple of guys fishing together on the far side of the lake, and I wanted to interview them for some stories I've been working on. Now, I got to tell you, getting onto the ice, I had to jump from the bank because there was water against the shore. Once I got out there, I talked to Mike Davis, who had not been catching much that day, but he did have a couple of perch and bluegill. He ice fishes a lot, and he's seen some changes over the years.
I have noticed. It seems like when I was younger, me and him was talking about it the other day, too. It seems like we used to get like a foot of ice, and then now it's like we're down to 4 inches.
And that's mostly the story for lakes across the state. Things are not quite the same. Some years, though, there's a lot of ice. You remember the polar vortex, right?
Of course. Boy, I have to ask, Lester, I hate to play armchair climatologist, but you got to wonder if this is due to climate change.
Yeah, well, in any given year, it's just variations in the weather, right? So I've been talking to some researchers, though, and they say things are definitely changing.
In what way?
Well, in some cases, we're seeing the longest ice cover on lakes that's ever been measured. Some years, there's less ice than ever. It's really volatile from year to year. But when you step back and you look at what's happening over the decades, it becomes a little clearer. Joe Noner with the Michigan Department of Natural Resources was telling me about one case.
For example, Gull Lake over in Barry and Kalamazoo counties, we've lost about 22 days of ice in a typical year since the 1920s. So we're seeing shorter ice periods. We're seeing warming summer surface water temperatures. So lakes are getting warmer. And then we're seeing changes in fish communities.
So fish such as cisco are getting harder to find. They're cold water fish. And even cool water fish such as walleye are getting more scarce in some lakes.
So what's that going to mean for ice fishing in the future, do you think?
Well, it means change. I mean, we're going to continue to see some really hard freezes some years, and other years we're going to see short ice seasons. But the overall trend, especially in the southern part of Michigan, is fewer and fewer days of ice cover, measurable over the decades, not just year to year.
Lester Graham of the Environment Report. Lester, thanks for filling us in.
Sure.
For a lakeside view of what's going on, we turn now to Myron Gilbert. He lives in Brooklyn and is a member of the U.S. World Ice Fishing Team, past gold medalist. He fishes all over Michigan when he's not competing on the global level. And he also is the owner of a charter boat service that runs in the summertime. Fresh back from Illinois, he joins us now. Myron Gilbert, welcome back to Stateside.
Well, good to be talking with you, April.
Hey, so how's the season going this year?
Oh, well, it started off a little slow and warm, you know, and we didn't have a lot of ice at first, but now things have cooled off pretty dramatically, and where I live is on the edge of the ice belt pretty typically. North of me is usually really good, you know, everything, but it kind of varies on the ice belt, you know, where it goes every year,
right?
How far south it works and everything, but we're having good ice now, and the fishing's been good. I've been all over, and like I said, I just come back from Illinois fishing in a tournament. We had good ice there, but I did it in Bay Chicago. I did get it out then in snowfall, so that was, winter was upon us, so it tested us
sure.
a little bit, but yeah, it was good to be out. It was good to be out.
Myron, I know that this is a sensitive question to ask any fisherman, but do you mind telling us about some of your favorite spots in Michigan?
Oh, I do. I got us a few favorite spots. You know, I like bigger lakes myself because they hold a lot more fish, you know, better than small bodies of water. I like big bodies of water. There's a lot more fish, a lot more opportunity. Then you can spread out where you're not crowded and everything. But a lot of smaller lakes have some tremendous fishing in them also, you know. There's just all kinds of opportunities, from small lakes to flowages. We got all kinds here in Michigan. We got so many bodies of water. We're really blessed to have all the opportunities that we have.
Yeah.
I have a lot of good friends. We get around fishing on all of them, and it's real enjoyable.
What's a typical day on the ice like for you?
Typical day on the ice is we go out in the morning and go to like our favorite spots and everything. We got some pretty good electronics. I'll tell you what, that's really been an eye opener. We got graphs and we got like a new thing that's really come on. It's called a panoptics, where you can shine around and see the fish out quite a ways from you. So that way, you know, you're on the fish all the time, and it really makes it pretty exciting, you know, to fish with these new electronics and everything. Holy mackerel, you know, it's not like we're fishing blind anymore. You know, it's like on my charter boat, you know, a lot of electronics use.
Wait a minute. Are you saying something like the iFish app or these electronics that you use, that they actually work through the ice?
No, it's like a graph, I guess you'd call it, you know, that they've got, well, they got flash units and graphs. It's just like fish finders type of thing. There's just all different kinds of them, but they're quite an aid to fishing, you know. I mean, they work pretty good. That's all I can tell you. It really helps with the young people, the graph stuff and everything. They're so electronic these days, you know. My granddaughter can show me a lot of stuff, but I'll tell you.
Sure. You know, we've heard that there's been a lot of variation in Michigan's lake ice from year to year, but that overall, if you're looking at it on like an 80-year scale, that we are trending towards warmer temperatures. What do you observe of lake ice in the past few winters?
Oh, I don't know. Back in 14 and 15, we had like old-time ice. You know, I mean, I've been around since, you know, when I graduated in 77, so I was telling you how old I am and everything, but We had a stretch of real cold winters there in 77, 78, 79, I do believe. And then we had a warming trend for a few years. And then I can't really remember exactly what years. But then like in 14 and 15, we had real extensive ice cover and was able to fish the Great Lakes quite a bit. Lake Erie is one of my favorites because it's a big, vast lake that I charter on it. And we had good ice out there where you could take machines and the whole lake was locked up, so it was safe. But the Great Lakes are very dangerous if you don't know exactly what you're doing, what you're getting into, and I don't recommend that for the novice. But the small ponds and lakes around home are much better for that. But I don't know about the global warming. Things change. You know, it's always changing. Weather's always changing. You know, the climate and all that. I don't know what to think. You know, I know that they say on average and everything, things are warmer, but we still do a lot of ice fishing here, and traditionally this was the boundary, right where I live, where good ice, like into Ohio, is not normal.
Right.
But into Michigan it is, that's kind of the boundary, like Chicago line, from there south, you never know, and from there north, you always have ice. That's kind of the boundary.
Sure. I mean, you have opportunities to fish all over the world and to talk with fishermen from all over the place. What are you hearing? What's the buzz within the sport about what people are seeing in winters and in some of the other places that you fished around the U.S. and around the world?
In the world competitions, I've been to Ukraine a couple times. I've been to Bulgaria, Belarus, Kazakhstan. I've been to, a lot of these countries. And I don't know, in Latvia there, they're like on the edge too, because it's close to the Black Sea and everything. And one year they have great ice, and then the next year not so much ice. So that's another place, where weather influences quite a bit. We went to Bulgaria, and it was a little warmer than usual, so we had to move lakes and move up into the mountains to fish where it was colder. Same thing like in Weir. If you go up in elevation, things are colder, so you have a lot better ice. Same thing in Vermont and stuff when I fished there. Because you got elevation, that helps freeze stuff up. Higher elevations are colder, and it gives better ice kind of things. But all my European friends, they're all fishing. I've been watching them on Facebook. They all over the pandemic's kind of shut down this year. We couldn't travel this year to Lithuania. But hopefully next year we'll get to go do that. Hopefully everything gets settled down here and we can start traveling around the world.
Yeah. Yeah, that's hard, not being able to get out there, I'm sure, but it's good to live in Michigan, I guess.
Yeah, I'm blessed.
A little more locally, folks who fish in this area may be aware that the Midwest Open in Irish Hills had to be put off because of changing, conditions.
COVID shut it down. We have plenty of ice here. To do with weather,
But the past couple of years, they have had to deal with a bit of that due to the variation. Do you ever hear people talking about varying their technique or where they're fishing just for their own enjoyment?
Oh, not really. As long as there's enough ice, we get on out there. That's not really so much for enjoyment. It's just that whatever the conditions allow, type of thing here. Looks like we got a pretty extensive cold snap coming. As I just looked at it, like a month out. All fishing here, it looks like we got pretty extensive cold, a lot more seasonal type weather. It was a little warmer earlier in the season, but it looks like it's going to cool off pretty dramatically. We're down into single digits and a lot of cold weather here. Even the Dakotas was quite a bit warmer than normal early in the season, but now the temperatures are all plummeting and it's a lot more typical weather, so we'll see what happens. You just never know. You got to get the season in before you really know.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite catch so far this winter?
Favorite catch?
Yeah.
Boy, I don't know. I was like hand fishing crappies and perch, and then I caught a big walleye out on Whoppers the other day, which was kind of, there's not a lot of them there, but I caught about a 5-pounder on real small, bluegill type tackle, so that was pretty fun.
Mm-hmm.
And, you get all kinds of fish when you're pan fishing. We catch bluegills, crappies, perch, bass, all kinds of stuff. Like, you never know what's next.
Maybe it's me, but I feel like I hear fewer fish stories out of ice fishermen than I do out of folks who...
Well, they're not. Maybe they don't lie. Maybe ice fishermen are like the true you can trust them type thing. But I wouldn't believe that if I was you.
I just wanted to thank you for that added level of trustworthiness that you bring to the sport.
Well, fish stories, I run a charter boat, so trust you me, I've heard plenty and I've even told one or two. it's been a pretty darn good winter here, and I'm just praying for everybody. Hopefully this COVID thing get around so we can all travel and enjoy ourselves and carry on with our families and do what we do. Fishing's been really good in my life. I've made a career out of it, as a matter of fact. So it's not really like a job to me. It's just, something I enjoy doing. So when I'm fishing every day, 7 days a week, for months at a time, I got to remind myself, remember, you're having fun here, So 4:30 in the morning every day comes quite early.
Well, being able to fish year-round is a beautiful thing. Myron, thank you so much for talking to us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I really enjoy it.
Myron Gilbert is a gold medalist on the U.S. World Ice Fishing Team.
Yeah, highlight of my career. When I stood on the podium, I cried. Let me tell you, when the national anthem plays, you know, my old, I competed, I wrestled and everything, you know, and I never thought when I'd be in my 50s, I'd be winning a world championship or something, you know. I never, never dreamed it, you know. When you get to stand on the podium and the national anthem plays, you get tears in your eyes. And then I want to make one comment about all the other countries when I fish in world competition. They're just as patriotic as any American is for their own country. When their national anthem plays, they cry too. So I got a lot of respect for them. And then the world over, you know, and from what I've seen, people are all the same as governments cause the problems, is what I've seen. You know, people are just good people the world over.
Myron, you're a peach. Thank you so much for talking to us.
You're very welcome.
So if the climate's a bit warmer, what does that mean for businesses that depend on snow? That is a thing in many parts of Michigan. Interlochen Public Radio's Dan Wanshura caught up with a few of them.
Mount Bohemia is a small ski resort in the very northern tip of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. It sits on land that juts out into Lake Superior. The views are stunning, and you can ski between old-growth maple and pine trees covered with snow. Getting more than 300 inches of fresh powder during the winter isn't uncommon in this part of the UP. Some say it's the best skiing this side of the Rockies.
It really sets itself apart, honestly. It doesn't really compare to other resorts.
That's John Royal, an avid skier who's been making trips up to Mount Bohemia for the past decade. He loves the tight glade runs, steeper terrain, and fresh, ungroomed trails. This year, Royal planned a trip to the resort with his 10-year-old son, Tyler. But when mid-January rolled around, there was no trip to plan because there wasn't enough snow.
It's really, really hard for a father to tell a son that we can't go on a trip, and not because of, we'll say, financial, but because Mother Nature's not cooperating. It sucks. It really does.
Resort President Lonnie Gleiberman says they're down about 150 inches of snow compared to last year.
We're just not getting Arctic air coming down from Canada.
For decades, the resort has relied on massive lake-effect snow dumps to attract skiers and snowboarders, but not this year. And the thought of buying and deploying snowmaking machines has never really been a consideration. But the warm winter this year is forcing Gleiberman to think about it. He says most of the feedback he's gotten so far about manufacturing snow has been negative.
It's like if you were the best New York pizzeria and you couldn't serve pizzas, so you put on chicken wings on your menu instead, you're still open for food, but that's not why your customers come to you. So we could be open with snowmaking runs, but that's not why the people drive 7 to 10 hours to ski us.
TNR Yamaha, it's Randy.
A 7-hour drive south in East Jordan, Michigan, Randy Danforth understands that logic and is facing a similar problem. In a normal winter, he'd now be busy selling and servicing snowmobiles. But like many in northern Michigan this year, he's glued to the weather forecast and praying for snow.
We can have the greatest product in the world. If we don't have snow in our area to sell the sleds, then they just don't sell.
Snow is critical not only for his business, but for the entire economy here. Bars, restaurants, motels, and other places depend on mounds of snow to bolster winter tourism.
The bread and butter months for an average snow community or snow place, December, January, and February are huge.
Some scientists say this year's warm winter in the Midwest is something we're likely to see more of. Richard Rood studies climate change at the University of Michigan and says consistently cold winters as we've known them in the past may not be realistic anymore.
We are not going to be able to have the same relationship to the climate and to the environment that we have had over our lifetimes and over our parents' and grandparents' lifetimes.
And that means outdoor winter pastimes like ice fishing or skiing and snowmobiling in the Midwest could melt into memories sooner than later. And the economies, depending on consistent snow and freezing temperatures, might not be far behind. For Stateside, I'm Dan Wanshura in Interlochen.
And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and our director, Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. We get additional help from Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. See you tomorrow.